BR, but don't forget to mention a time for prayer. And then if you have personal prayer requests or correspondence, you can write to A Time for Prayer at P.O. Box 2032, Crescent City, California, 95531. Again, that's A Time for Prayer, P.O. Box 2032, Crescent City, California, 95531. Thank you, bless you, and until next time, remember to keep on praying, worshiping God, and reading His Word, that He would flood you with His joy. In the name of Jesus, we pray these things. Amen.
Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because, of course, we have with us this evening Mr. John Nash. And Mr. Nash works back in our nation's capital, trying to educate people about what's happening to America's jobs. Do you realize that since President Bush became the President of the United States, we've lost about 2.6 million jobs here in the United States? Now, I'm not blaming this on President Bush. This was going on certainly under Bill Clinton. But it's all part of the NAFTA, World Trade Organization program, of shifting our industries overseas. Actually, of course, we reward our companies for going overseas. A company can go overseas and make profits if those profits are brought back to the United States to put into industry here. They have to pay a 35% tax on them if they leave them overseas. Why, they can invest them in other countries and, of course, build other plants in other countries. And, of course, they don't pay any taxes on it at all. Now, if you were a corporation, wouldn't you do that and build up your industry in other countries? Well, with us, Mr. Nash is going to get into the background of these insane policies we have, which are stripping America of its heavy industrial jobs, and now, of course, its white-collar jobs, and are eventually going to result in the impoverishment of the American people. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight, John.
It's a pleasure.
Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are, who you work for, and why you're concerned? I mean, after all, did we ever have it so good? Look how cheap we can buy things from other countries.
Okay, well, thank you. And if you will, I prefer to go by Jock. It's a nickname that I have.
Jock, okay, Jock.
John is correct, but Jock is what I go by. But we've got a situation where, I would guess for 20 or 30 years, America has changed its culture in many ways. If we want something, we want it now. And if we can't afford it, we just buy it on credit. And so we've got American families that are turning into, they're the wonder of the world, the American consumer. And we are now consuming about $1.4 billion a day more than we produce.
And of course, that all then is the trade deficit that we're developing. What's our trade deficit going to be this year? Or do you have any idea?
It's a bit early in the year to be guessing, but it's running at a rate of $500 billion.
$500 billion. We're spending more than we're making. What family could do that and get away with it?
Well, no families are getting away with it. If the average household of four has a credit card debt of $18,000, it's a frightening prospect. There are people that look at these kind of things and think long term, whether it's a Warren Buffett or a George Soros or any of the folks that are out there, and they say that we're in for some pretty wild times, economically speaking. We've moved our production offshore. We've moved these jobs offshore. We don't have the revenue base. It's a frightening thing that we're in a downward spiral.
In fact, I see Warren Buffett is investing now in China petrol company. In other words, he's beginning to invest Berkshire Hathaway's money in communist China, feeling that they have a better future than many American corporations.
Well, a lot of money has been... China has an economy that is approximately $1 trillion a year in gross domestic product. Our economy is $10.5 trillion a year. notwithstanding that, China became the largest recipient of foreign direct investment in the world of sometime, I guess it was October or November of last year. So they're attracting more investment than anywhere else, even though they're infinitely smaller than we are. I mean, our tenth our size. So it's extraordinary what they're doing.
And of course, a lot of American corporations are simply shifting their manufacturing base to China and manufacturing the products there and then bringing them back to the United States. And they don't have to pay the taxes there. They don't have to pay any income taxes here. They're making out like bandits.
Well, that's the thing. You know, corporations will do whatever civil society or whatever the government tells them to do ultimately. Our government has been on a free trade kick for about 30 years, and we've been running chronic and growing trade deficits. And so today, in 2003, we are running trade deficits with most all countries and most regions in the world, and those are chronic and growing. And our trade deficits, if you look at it just in by manufacturing sector, you know, textiles and steel and automotive, transportation, things like that. We're having growing trade deficits in every industrial sector. The evidence couldn't be more clear that something is awry, that something is not working. And what that is we're experiencing something new. Corporations are now moving their jobs and their production offshore and sending their stuff back here.
But of course, our government is actually encouraging that by its policies. And in fact, in the past, they subsidized that. I don't know if they're still subsidizing it, but certainly they're encouraging it with the tax laws, taking down our tariff barriers. And of course, and it's really not free trade. It's a controlled trade. It's not everything is free and open. Certain industries are favored and others are not. But of course, what this is going to do is eventually going to level the entire world's working men. In other words, certainly our workers will have to, of course, compete with the workers in China, and we'll raise the living standards of that of the American citizen to that of the Chinese peasant.
So that's what they, in economic theory, they call factor price equalization. If you want to compete with sweatshop labor, you have to be a sweatshop yourself. It's quite simple, but there's this notion that free trade is something that was accepted and adopted and believed in by our founding fathers, and they, through the Commerce Clause, guaranteed that we would have free trade.
But only among our state, not over the rest of the world. They put tariffs
right.
on to protect our industry.
That's among our several states. But in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, they go in and they talk about they want the Congress to regulate international commerce because there's all kinds of dangers there. When we drop our tariffs, the effect of our dropping our tariffs is to put our working men and women in direct competition with working men and women elsewhere. I'm talking about unskilled and blue-collar work. And with that, when you compare like Chinese, Vietnamese, or Cambodian wages, $40 a month, we can't compete with that. It's no disgrace, but we just cannot. And so why is it that we should allow our products to be made there and then sold here? All we do is take the American worker out of the formula. And that movement of those jobs offshore is you're absolutely right. Congress is the one that's doing that.
And of course, the other thing is where it said, well, you know, but of course, we'll become a service economy, you know, and we'll have high-tech economy, but aren't a lot of our high-tech jobs going offshore too?
Yes, and then the service economy and the information economy is I guess it's a phase that countries go through and people write these things down, and we had our period where we were an agrarian country, and then we became industrialized, and now people say that we're going into the information age. Okay, well, I'll accept that. But when we moved from an agrarian economy into an industrial economy, we didn't get rid of agriculture. And if we start moving toward the directions of information economy, we shouldn't get rid of our manufacturing. But now what happens with manufacturing, and I work for a wonderful and great manufacturing corporation, most of the innovation and things that happen in manufacturing happen on the factory floor. Now, if the factory floor is in China, that's where the research and development and the innovation is going to occur. The dynamics and the synergies are lost. For what? So some corporation can sell you 6 T-shirts instead of 4? That doesn't make sense.
Well, of course, this whole idea of free trade is something that was championed by the British, and it destroyed the British economy. England today is the second caste nation, directly because of their free trade policies. Why are we doing something which is detrimental to the well-being of the American people? Is there a larger agenda behind this whole thing?
I'm not. You know, I don't know of larger agendas. I know that you can look at these kind of things and you can say, well, let's look at it from this perspective, that since the beginning of time, who gets the value added when something is made? The pendulum kind of swings between the investor or the worker. And what's happened over the last 20 or 30 years is that this pendulum has kind of been pegged over on the side of capital and not on the side of the worker. And so decisions are being made, and the political money follows these kind of decisions are being made to benefit securities firms, financial companies. I mean, a bank makes money whether it's an import or an export. And so they could really care less. Some of the big companies like Archer Daniels Midland and Cargill and ConAgra, they're marketers of agricultural products. They don't really care if it's Australian wheat they're selling or American wheat. And so we've let these merchants and these financial merchants take over our agenda and take over our country.
Well,
everything.
Well, then why don't the American people stand up? Do you think that there is a conscious effort to keep the American people from realizing that our future is at stake, that 20 years down the line, there are going to be very few industrial jobs and very few white-collar jobs, and the only way that this thing can work is to progressively lower the living standards of the average American?
I think people in corporate America today, and I think they have a deservedly black eye. They are venal. They are greedy. They think of themselves first and nothing else, not God, country, and other kind of things. They seem to be, you know, they're being paid 200, 300, 400 times the wages of their average worker, these CEOs. These people, their compensation is based on their securities and exchange filings every 3 months. And so that's what they want to look at what's that on that bottom line. They could give a flip on whether they've just devastated a town because they decided to move their factory from Oregon to Texas or from Texas to India. And that doesn't make any difference to them.
And I think really what's happening and what people don't understand is so many of our white-collar jobs are moving to India and Bangladesh and Pakistan, where you can actually hire people for a quarter of what they can get here. And if they can certainly answer the telephone and speak in decent English without an accent, you don't know that when you call in for support on your Dell computer, for instance, as my son did the other evening, to find out what suggestions I'd make so it would work better and overcome problems he was having. And after a nice conversation with a young man for 15 or 20 minutes, he asked where he lived, and he lived in Bangladesh.
Mm-hmm.
And he was answering the telephone in Bangladesh. It sounded like he was just next door. Our white-collar jobs are leaving America.
Oh, and it's not, you know, the call centers are one thing. That's kind of the new working poor. I mean, first of all, a lot of the call centers, the people that do that work, I mean, it's just extraordinarily hard. But these folks are, I had a call the other day, and the person was from Bangalore, Maine. and that was from a big bank in New York. But it's not just the telemarketing and fundraising and that kind of stuff, but all of the, you know, the big credit card companies are sending all of their bookkeeping stuff offshore. A huge accounting firm the other day polled all the 100 top financial services firms in the country, and by polling them, they determined that 2 million financial services jobs will be outsourced in the next 5 years.
2 million
Just in banking and securities and those kind of jobs that are handled by our college graduates and MBAs. You can have CAT scans and radiology work done here in the United States and is digitized and sent over, and they might be looking at your X-rays in India and sending back the information here. You know, just like an architect will send his ideas and plans, and they'll do all the drafting in India. So the architecture firms, an architecture firm can't compete. If the guy next door is having all of his drafting done in India, how can he compete?
Well, now, my understanding, we have about 14 million industrial jobs. Is that a good figure or not?
No. In manufacturing work, I can give you the exact number.
Okay. You're right on top of this, so you tell us what
Yeah, the exact number in April of 2003 is 16,251,000. Of those, 10,865,000 are production workers. Now, in the month of April, we lost 95,000 of those manufacturing jobs.
So over the last
12 months, we lost 549,000 manufacturing jobs. And it's not in some areas, like, oh, we're really good in some areas but not good in others. Every area except for one. Out of all the durable goods manufacturing sectors, and all out of all the non-durable goods like food, tobacco, textiles, apparel, paper, printing, you know, the non-durable stuff, there's only one industry that actually gained jobs in the last 12 months, and that was tobacco products. Every other one, electronics, transportation equipment, motor vehicles, aircraft, everything, lost jobs.
I understand even many of our the high-tech products that we use in our very sophisticated weapons, some of these are being made in communist China today. Have you heard that?
Well, and what happens is the Department of Defense will put out the contract. Someone, let's say, X-ray, ABC Aerospace will win the contract for a medium-range cruise missile or something. And when they do all the subcontract work, you know, all of the innards and the controls and the electronics, so most of that work has to be outsourced. And that's why we had a bit of a delay, and it caused a great deal of concern when we had the pending dock strike in Long Beach, because there were ships among the hundreds of tankers and freighters that were offshore, contained parts essential to the manufacture of cruise missiles and other exotic weapon systems.
Well, these are very, very amazing times. And, of course, once you export the wealth of a nation, then, of course, what is left? And everybody says, oh, well, this could never happen. America could never be destroyed. We're the greatest nation in the world. Well, we were once the greatest nation in the world, but we lost our vision. We lost the desire, intention to preserve America. We turned our back on God. And we've got real problems in America, and I think it's about time people understand that there are people who are dedicated to globalization, the one world order, the new world economy. Well, when we get back here in just a moment, of course, we'll go on with our special guest, Jock Nash, and invite your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Jock Nash, and we're talking about, of course, what's happening to jobs. You know, and of course, it was amazing how they got the American people and, of course, members of Congress to go along with NAFTA. They said, boy, now we've just got a little superior, we've got a good balance of payment with Mexico, but just imagine we got all these Mexicans down there and they can buy our products, and if we just open up our borders to Mexico, why, we can sell a lot more products, and instead of just having a little budget of payment surplus, we'll have a big budget of payment surplus, you know, with Mexico. And of course, what happened? We took down our tariff barriers. Our industries began moving south of the border. Instead of having a little budget surplus, we had a gigantic budget deficit. But then, not to be outdone, they did the same thing with the World Trade Organization. Oh, we got to bring China into the World Trade Organization. We got 1.25 billion people over there. They're all going to be buying cars. They're going to be buying refrigerators. They're going to be buying all these wonderful things from us. And so we just want to take down our barriers. Well, of course, China doesn't play by the same rules. They've done everything they could to keep our products out, to make them certainly undesirable over there. And, of course, what we have now is what, $60, $80 billion deficit with communist China? Jock?
Yes. Well, our deficit with China is over $100 billion now.
$100 billion a year.
Yes, and... You know, even Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations had his four exceptions to free trade. And one of those exceptions was, you don't trade with somebody who doesn't trade with you. It's not really complicated. In other words, we should go ahead and trade with China. But if they don't want to buy our things, why should we buy theirs? I mean, if Adam Smith had a notion of balanced trade, and... our government's violating all four exceptions that Adam Smith 200 years ago put into his book Wealth of Nations, which is the Bible, so-called, of the free traders, which I guess there are a lot of people that have different interpretations, but it's insane what's happening.
Well, I agree with you, but then what can the average person do? I mean, the average person hears a program like this, and if he's out of a job, why, he's desperate to get one. If he already has a job, it doesn't involve him, so why should he be involved, concerned? Maybe he's got a nice government job. Of course, the trouble is a lot of these nice government jobs are beginning to disappear, too, as our economy begins to...
Government's doing very nicely. We're losing manufacturing jobs by the bushel basket full, but government at local, state, and federal levels seems to keep growing, which is going to cause a huge problem, as you can understand. When you lose 2 million manufacturing jobs, like we've lost in the last 2 years, it's an easy thing to remember, 2 million manufacturing jobs in 2 years. That's 2 million families that just dropped out of the middle class. They're no longer paying income taxes, federal, state, and local, the way they used to. They might have had to sell their house. They're not paying property taxes. They might have had to sell one of their cars. It's a way that the economy starts to ripple back up to politics in Washington. And you ask what people can do. It's really simple. Your members of Congress, and there are 535 of them, 435 in the House of Representatives, and, of course, 100 in the Senate.
I'm going to have to intervene just for a moment, Jock. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our friend this evening, special guest, is Jock Nash, who works for a corporation in Washington, D.C., but a corporation that's very concerned about what's happening to our industrial base, and I know that his employer and the people he works with are doing everything they can to awaken the American people as to what's going on. So pick up there where I...
What can we do about it?
Interrupted you, right. What can we do was the question.
Yeah.
What can the average individual do about this bleeding of American jobs? And this insane policy of our Congress and our Senate and our leaders to basically gut the industrial heart of this country.
Well, it's almost so simple, and maybe that's why it's not being done. But you have to remember that the 535 people I mentioned earlier, these elected members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, they may not care about your job, but they really care about their job. I mean, they love their job. And they want that job next year and the election after that and the election after that and the election after that. All people have to do, and it's not difficult, because no matter where you are in this country, you have a congressional district office that you can call, usually without even a toll of any sort. You can just look in the phone book under federal offices, U.S. Congress, and find who your congressman is, and call their office. And you tell them that if they keep voting for these, gosh, these god-awful trade agreements that benefit investors and banks and securities firms and multinational corporations with suspect national loyalties, then you're going to make sure that that congressman doesn't get elected again. And that you just, all you do is call their office and give them that message. Talk to somebody that knows about trade and just tell them to get that message to their boss in Washington. If people started doing that, that's all they would have to do. I've been a chief of staff of a U.S. senator. If we started getting 10, 15 calls to our state offices, we were talking to the senator right away, saying we got a problem, And the American people have to make the political system work. Otherwise, it's going to be handled in the streets.
And now, of course, there was a congressman from Utah, I don't remember his name, but he was a good conservative Republican, and he voted against NAFTA. He said, maybe it was the World Trade Organization, he said, I just can't support this. And the Republican Party ran somebody in the primary against him to get him out, wouldn't give him any money, slandered him in the local newspaper. They destroyed this congressman who had the courage to vote for the American people rather than the corporates. And the corporations, and of course the people who work with them, they give money to the leaders of the political parties to bribe the congressmen to vote the way they want to, or they give them direct gifts. And now, of course, the most amazing thing is this whole thing that was sold to the American people in the name of, we've got to do it with soft money, it's corrupting the system. And incidentally, of course, we'll put a little appendum in there in case, so that nobody can run political ads and tell anybody what the congressman's voting record is within 60 days of the election. And then, of course, they found out it's all right to give the soft money, but they're going to leave the thing in so you can't run political ads and tell people what the congressman's voting record is. So the average person has no idea what's going on. He isn't concerned until the election comes, and then all he knows is what he reads in the newspaper. And what they've done is suppress any real effort to inform the people how our congressmen are voting, and, of course, allow the soft money to continue coming in. That's the most incredible thing in the world.
It really is retail politics. You pay your money at the counter, and the congressman or senator does what you want. And I'll tell you, the big corporations, I mean, they're responsible for the big fundraising for these guys in Washington, and we've let them take control of the system. But it gets back down. Everybody hates the Congress, but they seem to keep voting their congressman back in. That's the safest job in America today, is of the people who ran, of the members of Congress and the Senate who ran last time, less than 2% got defeated. Now, that's pretty good.
Well,
everybody keeps sending them back.
Right, of course, and it's going to continue until there are enough people out there who care. And that's why you and the listening audience need to set up an institute in the Constitution to begin to educate people about what's going on, and set up your groups in your own community. Maybe you can only influence one congressional district, but wouldn't it be wonderful if we had just a couple of congressmen back there who really believed in our Constitution and dedicated to its preservation. We're going to be back here right after this break. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Jock Nash, and of course we're talking about America's disappearing jobs. One of the callers had called in and wanted to know how long foreigners are going to keep taking the American dollar. The American dollar has dropped some 26% here in the last, year and a half, something like that. And they have to understand that means that the actual purchasing power of the American dollar has fallen. The people out there who have their money in bonds or pension funds have lost 26% of the value of their currency in a relatively short period of time. And I believe that this is just the beginning of what we're going to see. The average individual doesn't seem to really care very much as long as it's somebody else's job. But of course, most people say, well, we've got enough money, salt it away, we'll be fine. Well, they thought that in Hitler's Germany in the 1930s. Nothing to worry about. Everything's going to be just fine. But of course, we are all involved in what's going on. How long do you think foreigners are going to keep taking American dollars? As long as the value of the dollar keeps falling, a lot of foreigners were investing in our stock market, and they just did great for a time. And then when the bubble burst, they shared in the loss of, what, $6 or $10 trillion in value. We're having real problems, and I don't think the average American really understands. Do you?
No, and you know, they said if people could understand the Federal Reserve System, there'd be a revolution tomorrow. So I'm not sure, but I can tell you that what happens when you run a trade deficit, and if you look at it in the broadest measure, and that's what they call the current account balance. In that broadest measure, we are, like we mentioned, it'll be over $500 billion for 2003. And it was almost that in 2002. And if you add them all up, and you must, then you're getting to $2.5 to $3 trillion that is we owe one way or the other. That means people can get paid back. They'll come here and they'll buy Chrysler. And King, now it's called Daimler Chrysler.
And they'll buy a German concern is what you're saying.
That's right. That's what happens. They're coming here and they're buying our country. They're buying our electrical utilities. They're buying our water. They're buying our grocery stores. They own 40% of the factories in America. And so that's what we're leaving our children. This is the greatest country the world has ever known, created on the greatest sacrifice of millions of Americans, and we're frittering it away because somebody says, I've got to buy a T-shirt for what? You know, does someone think because Nike shoes are now made in Indonesia that they no longer cost $110 when they come across the border? You know, it's not cheaper necessarily because the jobs are gone, but it is it's devastation for us.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And incidentally, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Hi, Bill. How are you doing tonight?
Hi. Pretty good, Dr. Stan. I just wanted to make a quick comment, and this is obviously something that you already know, but I thought it's worth mentioning again, that all of this with first AFTA and then GATT is a plan that both the Democrats and the Republicans have been heavily involved with going back as far as I can remember to Carter. And they succeeded in the last 15, 20 years putting these two acts in, which are, I think, the basis for what you're talking about tonight with the runaway of our industrial base and the corporations going overseas and becoming international, and forgetting that they were probably born and raised here in the United States, but they've lost their allegiance to this country and gone transnational. But the point of information I guess I wanted to say before I get off is, when you mentioned calling your congressman or whatever, and I don't think we should ever give up on that, but I do remember when GATT was passed, there were so many phone calls going into offices like Bob Dole's office that these guys could not even make phone calls themselves. They couldn't call out of their own office.
And they really didn't care, did they?
The phone was ringing. I remember specifically the story about Bob Dole's office. The phone was ringing off the hook day and night going up to that vote for GATT. And he went right ahead and voted for it.
I know. Well, of course.
It meant absolutely nothing to these people. They went ahead and pushed it through because that's what big business wanted.
Well, of course. But remember, he was awarded by being allowed to run for president. Anyway, thanks so much, Bill, and I think you're absolutely right.
I wouldn't be quite that pessimistic because there's been major movement since that GATT vote, and that was in 1993-94. There's been a sea change. NAFTA is now an epithet. It's a pejorative in the English language.
Then why don't they repeal it?
Well, that's what comes next. We had Congressman Ron Paul has introduced legislation to vote us out of the WTO.
Well, of course,
and vote us out of the NAFTA. And I'll tell you, when Trade Promotion Authority, or so-called Fast Track, the vote that they got last year, they only won that vote by 3 votes.
Yeah, but of course, so they bribed some of the very good conservatives to go along with that, and
yes,
really turned their back on everything they stood for and betrayed their constituents. But the average constituent will never know about Pombo switching his vote and a few of the others to betray the American people.
But,
who opposed it right up to the very end and then said, gee, on a matter of principle, I thought I'd vote for it.
But they're feeling the effects. The American people are starting to make their views known in Washington, and they should not slow down at all.
No, we're not going to.
For example, we have a group. It's called the American Manufacturers Trade Action Coalition, and we're getting new members, like dozens of new members all the time, and we've got a. We're associated with all different groups in states all over the country that are meeting. They're going to these town hall meetings loaded with charts and graphs, waiting to talk to their congressmen. And I'll tell you, it's starting to have an effect. And you watch. We're now in a presidential election cycle. And President Bush will only have one term, just like his father. If he doesn't do something, and do something quick, because
like maybe precipitate another terrorist attack to rally the people behind him.
Well, you know, if he has to, ultimately, I think in 2004, people are going to be voting their pocketbooks.
I think you're absolutely right. Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. Feeling armed and dangerous tonight. I want to ask your guest some questions.
Well, we'll give you one question or maybe 2 questions. Go ahead.
Well, Stan, you asked a question a little while ago. Is there a larger agenda behind this whole thing?
Well, now, of course, remember, Jack works for a corporation, so is it somewhat limited?
Not very, Dr. Stan. I work for a man named Roger Milliken.
Right.
He just won the Durand Quality Award. He was awarded that yesterday. It's one of the most prestigious quality awards in the... And he is a fighter on this issue. There's nothing that I'm holding back for you or your listeners.
Well, but then, of course, the thing is there a move towards a globalization, towards this this one-world system that I think that Mike is alluding to?
Well, now, is Roger Milliken any relation to Michael Milliken?
No,
Michael Milliken was a securities guy. Roger Milliken's family has been in the textile and chemical industry for 150 years. He has a company that's got 16,000 people, and it's an extraordinary corporation, manufacturer.
Well,
he actually lives in Greenville, South Carolina. That's where the company is anyway, and it's certainly one of the major textile manufacturers in this country, and they've gutted the textile industry here.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, we've lost, since NAFTA, Mike, we in textiles and apparel, so since 1994, we've lost 750,000 jobs in just textiles and apparel. Those are Americans that no longer have that job.
Okay, well, go ahead, Mike. What was your point?
Jack used a question, a phrase a little while ago. Said, factor of price equalization.
Factor price equalization.
Can you explain that? And I'll tell you what
I wish
I'm
could. I'm a lawyer. I'm not an economist. And so I'm not a practitioner of the dismal science. But basically what factor price equalization is that at some point, there's going to be a leveling. Now, someone says, well, we should trade with Mexico. And by the way, I'm not saying anything about no trade and our building walls and doing all this other kind of stuff. But there are some people that were for NAFTA that said, what we have to do is we have to have a free trade agreement with Mexico. Then Mexico, a lot of jobs are going to be created in Mexico, and they're all going to become rich like us, and then they're going to be buying stuff that we make. Well, it's, you know, we have now, just with Canada and NAFTA, an $89 billion trade deficit with Canada and Mexico. An $89 billion deficit. Mexico is not buying anything from us. The only thing Mexico buys from America is equipment to build factories. And those are American investors, American corporations going down to Mexico, building their factory, buying the parts for the factory from America, creating goods and sending the goods back to the United States. None of the stuff that we sell in Mexico enters into their stream of commerce.
Okay,
factor of price equalization then.
Their wages would go up. They would be but we can't compete with penny wage labor.
Okay, the whole thing it sounds remarkably similar to a phrase I've heard from somewhere else before. It goes like this: redistribution of the wealth.
And from those who according to their ability, to each according to their need, right? That was, I think that some fellow named Karl Marx said that.
Marxism really? They propose a grand cultural scheme that would favor the little people, but really it's nothing more than a sales pitch for fascist control. You made another statement. We've let financial merchants take over our country. I've been taking notes.
Mm-hmm.
Financial merchants taking over our country, don't we call that fascism?
Well, you know, it's extraordinary that the power of the securities and banking industry in Washington. I'm from Nevada. I was born in Nevada, raised in Nevada, but I've been living out here for 25 years. Got stuck out here after law school. And the power in this town of the banking industry is makes your eyes roll back.
In other words, basically, of course, fascism was a corporate sort of socialism where you had an elite who ran the country working along with a leader who was Benito Mussolini. Benito Mussolini is no longer around, but we seem to have a financial elite that is directing the course of so many of the policies of this country. Would that be a fair statement to make?
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else, Mike?
We once had a president who said, it's the economy, stupid.
I think the money is where the power is.
Not military, not politics. It's the money.
Remember, he was given a nice little $10 million advance on a book he hasn't written when he left office. Let's not just pick on Bill Clinton. President Reagan left office, he took a trip to Japan, was paid $2 million for going over there and giving a couple of talks. And they interviewed Nancy. They showed something on CBS last night on 60 Minutes. I guess it was on Sunday. And of course, Nancy said, "But we had to work very hard while we were there."
Not that they did.
Right.
Jacques said something very interesting a little while ago. If the people understood the Federal Reserve, there would be a revolution. I wonder if you could expand on that and help us why there should be a revolution.
You know, I would say it's a consensus view that one of the most powerful people in the United States is the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Now, I didn't elect Chairman Greenspan, and nor did you. And he's in charge of the Federal Reserve, which is in charge of the federal banking system and all the banks in the United States. It's a self-regulatory group. I mean, there's not, you know, no one elected anybody to that job, and he's got one dial he can play with, the interest rates, he's just running out of dial is what he's running out of, because if you probably recall from history that during the Great Depression we had interest rates at 0.25%, and people still couldn't borrow any money, and so he's running out of interest rate cuts to try to try to make us keep buying, even though we've got $18,000 of credit card debt per family, is absolutely amazing.
And of course, I think people have to understand that the Federal Reserve System is not a grant of the federal government. It is a privately owned central bank that they called the Federal Reserve to create the perception that it was had to do with our government. But if you look at the telephone book in any community where there is a Federal Reserve Bank, you'll find it not listed not in the area of government organizations, but in the area where private corporations are listed, because the Federal Reserve Bank is a privately owned organization, and yet it directs the economy of our country. An awful lot of power to give to people who are not answerable to the people of that nation, if indeed we are a representative government. Anything else, Mike? One more question now.
Supposedly, the chairman of the Federal Reserve is appointed by the president.
But of course, every chairman of the Federal Reserve System since 1953 has come from the Council on Foreign Relations. Every chairman of the Federal Reserve System going back to 1913, with one or two exceptions, has come from the membership roles of the Council on Foreign Relations. And those of you who don't know what the Council on Foreign Relations is, I suggest you read Tragedy and Hope, written by Bill Clinton's mentor, Professor Carol Quigley. The Council on Foreign Relations is a front for a secret society called the Round Table Group, which was originated in 1891 by a man named Cecil Rhodes, who created the Great Diamond Cartel that no government dares challenge, no government in the world dares to challenge. Anything, Mike?
Well, in my opinion, the president is told who to appoint.
I'm sure he is.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else, Mike?
Well,
okay. we'll let you go, but
yeah, okay.
Thanks very much. So our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question, our guest today is Jacques Nash, and of course, he has worked for Roger Milliken, and they're on the front lines trying to get the American people to see the suicidal policies that our government is following today. And NAFTA and the World Trade Organization will impoverish this country and destroy the financial foundation of our freedom and, of course, the financial future of our children. So, we know these things. We can see them happening. We've lost 1 million jobs in 2 years, and what is it, about 2.7 million or 2.6 million since George Bush became president, like that?
He's virtually every president since Truman has created jobs at a rate of 60,000 to 250,000 jobs a month for each month of their administrations. President Bush, since he came into office, has lost 60,000 jobs a month. I mean, it's a nightmare. Yeah, he might not be responsible for it. I read some reports today that econometric folks that look at these kind of things and they can plot when economies start going up and they start going down. Well, the economy started heading south on us during the Clinton administration, but the effects weren't seen until a little bit later. Regardless, his trade policies are exactly the same as President Bush's trade policies. And Clinton's were the same as Jerry Ford's, were the same as Ronald Reagan's, as a Bush one. They've all agreed to this. And it's in the circles that they travel in, this they can't pass a saliva test thinking that this is going to raise all the ships of the world, that all the world is better off for this. Maybe the world is. We are not. And we have to get our politicians thinking about America first, our friends second, and then the other people, well, they have to worry about themselves. It's not our job.
Well, you never will help the poor people by destroying the rich people, and that's exactly what this is all about. It's, as I think as Mike said, it's about this old concept, from each according to their ability, to each according to their need, and that's exactly what we have so much. Why shouldn't we share all we have with the rest of the people in the world? But look what's happening to the rest of the world. Are they really much better off? Are they really having more in the way of individual freedom in China and other countries?
Well, that's interesting. You know, you take an apparel job. A lot of Americans probably wouldn't want to do an apparel job, but You talk to apparel workers, they like the job just fine, thank you. But you take their job. They're earning $8.50 an hour, $9, $9.50 an hour. You take that job and you take it to Cambodia, it becomes a $40 a month job. This lady that was working in the apparel shop no longer has a job. I don't know what she's going to do about her children. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, but that's happening not just in those jobs, but electronics. The electronics industry lost. Let me get you the exact figure. In the last 12 months, electronic industry and electronic component industries together, 161,000 jobs in 12 months. Gone. That's the high-tech stuff. And they're gone, never to return, if we let these people keep on with their philosophy. And my philosophy, and the one of Roger Milliken and Sir James Goldsmith before him, is that we encourage, in fact, we invite all foreign corporations. We welcome them to become corporate citizens of America. We ask them to bring their capital, bring their technology, come to America, invest in a manufacturing plant, hire Americans at American wages, and compete on the only level playing field that exists, the playing field among the several states that we talked about earlier. Same minimum wage, same EPA, same labor conditions, same exchange rate, same everything. We're not afraid of competition. We're just not going to put our workers in competition with people that earn pennies an hour.
Amen to that. Well, let's go to Dave, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
Yes, just fine. Thank you. I had a couple of questions. One, our first statement is that I really think we all have to fight this third worlding of America, because you can't really be free unless you have a certain degree of financial freedom first. If you're financially enslaved, there's no freedom. I continually used to hear Clinton talk about free and fair trade, and I think I've heard George II also use that terms together as if they were the same thing, and I've heard definitions for fair trade that was quite different. I was wondering if you could define what you think fair trade is.
Yes, could you? That's a very important question. Go ahead.
That is a typical blue smoke and mirrors political politician's statement. He's spinning. They're presumably, free trade is unregulated trade, and no one knows what's going to happen, and it just helter-skelter, and that's the way capitalism is supposed to be. And there are absolutists that believe that. Then there are people that say, oh, I don't believe in that unregulated stuff. I'm not going to import rugs made by children. I'm not going to import stuff that was put together in Myanmar or Burma, where they treat their people like goats. I'm not going to do that. I want fair trade, and I'm not going to make our people compete with that. Well, I tell those fair traders, what have you done about it? How do you have fair trade with China? What do you do? What do you do when you say, well, I've got an engineering student here, and I'd like to pay him $85,000 a year to start? And in China, an engineering student that might have gone to the same American university is going to be paid $12,000. And the American engineer can't compete with that Chinese. He just could not. Simply cannot. And never will. And we have to put a stop to this notion that somehow we can level the playing field. That somehow we can tell governments, oh, no, you can't have a national bank. Oh, no, you can't have the state own your transportation. They can't own your railroads. They can't own those kind of things. And we'll just have it free trade, but everybody will be equal. That's never going to happen. That's as utopian as free trade.
Well, but Jacques, one of the things that they talk about fair trade, and that is where trade is actually regulated. For instance, we take our the tariffs and cut them off completely, and we allow the other country to keep their tariffs on for 10 years so they can build up their economies. Or we will regulate simply certain industries and other industries, and we don't regulate. Isn't that true?
Well, yeah, and I mean, a tariff is nothing to be ashamed of. The second act of the first Congress in at the beginning of our country, the first thing they did was put up tariff barriers so that they could develop a domestic manufacturing base. And that's what they did. And we turned out to be the greatest country in the history of the planet.
And, of course, it was in large part because, first of all, we did not tax the individual. We had tariffs and certain custom taxes.
Yeah, that's right.
And, of course, people were free to keep the money they made, and we could support our entire government simply based upon our tariffs and these other charges. And now, of course,
that was the definition I heard for fair trade was a tariff set that was equal to the cost of manufacture plus a fair profit.
So well, that's set for that's
that.
What you want
then
to
you
do. You want to
a good system.
You want to raise
think,
the tariff.
I think the Republican
so that,
Party was formed in order to set good and fair trades.
Well,
that free trade is something that I believe. I don't know whether I read somewhere back Karl Marx thought of free trade.
Absolutely. Karl Marx realized it would destroy America. That's why he advocated. That's why
right
our leaders are pushing this today. Either they've never read Karl Marx or they have and they don't want us to know. Hey, we're out of time, Dave. Thanks so
all
much
right,
for calling.
Thank you.
Nathan's on the line, but Nathan, you're going to have to wait till the next hour because we're out of time, too. I'd love to talk to you. But right now, of course, I want to thank you so much, Jacques, for being with us here. And
you,
it's been a real pleasure. I hope we can get you back on again.
Anytime. I love it. Thank
you. All right, fine. And, of course, our guest has been Jacques Nash from Washington, D.C., or the environs there. And, of course, he's a spokesman bringing us up to date. He has all the figures. And, of course, what's going to happen is America is going to be impoverished. And, of course, we're going to become a second-rate nation. That is the plan. Transferring America's wealth to other nations. And, of course, as Dave was just saying, this whole idea of free trade originated with Karl Marx, the redistribution of the wealth. But you must understand, it's not, of course, the wealth of the wealthy. It's the wealth of the middle class. And this is how you impoverish the people, establish a ruling class, and you can already see the massive police state being put into place in the name of course, fighting the wicked Osama bin Laden, or is it the wicked Saddam Hussein, or it doesn't really matter who it is. We have to have an enemy. You always have to have an enemy. And we're losing our freedom, ladies and gentlemen. And so we hope that you'll join us in this epic struggle. You'll join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we speak out 5 hours every day on radio stations, on shortwave, on satellite, on internet, reaching a growing number of people. But quite frankly, we need your help to continue doing what we're doing. If you don't belong to the Radio Liberty family, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Perhaps you'd like to subscribe to the newsletter. Perhaps you'd simply like to get a free copy of the newsletter. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. The April newsletter goes into the planned genocide that's taking place today, not only in America, but throughout the world. And you say, well, I didn't hear any genocide, but then, of course, you wouldn't hear about that, would you, if you're not supposed to? And then we ask you, of course, to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders and for our ministers who should be leading the fight, because behind all of these efforts is what's going on today. Our spiritual forces are intent upon the destruction of America. Why? Because at one time America was a Christian nation. And lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan Goodnight. Oh, I guess it'll be Thursday. The Pastor Doug will be here tomorrow. Until Thursday, Dr. Stan Goodnight, and may the love, may the Lord be with you. Thank you. Well, good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls because, of course, we have this evening, the first few minutes, we'll have Randy Thomason with us from the Campaign for California Families, followed by Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute, followed by one of my favorite guests, and I hope he's one of yours as well. And that, of course, is Joel Skousen. So without further ado, let's go to Randy Thomason. Hi, Randy. How are you doing?
Doing well, Dr. Stan. Boy, what a radio day. I just was on Alan Combs' radio show.
I know. Where is that?
Oh, you know Hannity and Combs on Fox News?
Oh, Hannity and Combs. Okay, fine. Great.
Well, this is Alan Combs. He's got a talk show. He's a liberal one, but we were talking about adultery laws. So even though they're unenforceable, I say it sends a good message. He disagrees, but what do you expect?
All right, fine. Well, that's all right, because he has a right to be wrong.
Yes.
But, of course, he would deny you probably the right to have your opinion, as so many liberals do.
Well, you know, laws all are based on somebody's view of morality. Every single law is based on something that's moral. And so as we merge now into what's happening in Sacramento, the state capital of California, when the people of California make the law that says marriage is only for a man and a woman, that is correct before God. It's correct before nature. It's correct before the children and what's best for them. And it's correct before the records of the voters, because 3 years ago, that's what the people said. Now, I have been talking about this before, but it bears repeating. And Dr. Stan, you live in an area there on beautiful Monterey Bay where that may be the one vote for the entire state. A woman who's running for state senator there who may hold the key to the entire state on whether we're going to protect marriage or reverse the vote of the people and bring homosexual marriage to California. And I'd like to give her name and number because this is so intense. 2 weeks from tonight, 2 weeks and 2 days, we'll be able to say whether marriage has been protected in the state or not. And again, we're talking about a bill, AB 205, that would give all the rights of marriage under California law to homosexual partners. It's just amazing. Rebecca Cohn is her name. I'd urge you, if you live in Dr. Stan's area of the world, Monterey County, Santa Cruz County, call Rebecca Cohn at 916-319-2024 and urge her to oppose AB 205, which reverses the people's vote on marriage. It's just so important. I thought I would say that, Dr.
All right, fine. You certainly may. And if you agree with Randy, why, you should go ahead and call Rebecca at 916-319-2024. And if you disagree with him, of course, that's your right. 916-319-2024. And that, of course, is the bill. Is that H.R. 205?
No, it's an assembly bill, AB 205.
205.
It's a homosexual marriage bill to reverse the vote of the people.
Well, as somebody once said, if there is no ultimate authority or lawgiver, then anything goes. If there is no God, then, of course, why shouldn't we do whatever we want to do? And if there is a God, then we better jolly well pay attention to what he says. And if people follow God's laws, why, of course, you don't have the problems with breaking up of marriage and the disastrous effects on children, but you don't have all the sexually transmitted diseases. Look and see what we've wrought because of promiscuity, the number of what young women are having hysterectomies because of human papillomavirus, and the people having have colostomies because of rectal carcinoma because of human papillomavirus, and, of course, the spread of AIDS. It's already killed almost a half a million people here in the United States. And, of course, another 850,000 to 950,000 infected waiting to die. Of course, the herpes virus, syphilis, the gonorrhea, all of the tragedy, and it all comes because you broke God's law. And, of course, you had sex outside of marriage.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, it seems to be a disagreement between God and man on the word freedom. Well, man says, hey, I want to do anything I want. Anything I want is good, and I ought to be able to do it. Then we get a bunch of societal ills. Criminals do whatever they want. People who spread disease do whatever they want. And politicians who are criminal in their corruption, their derelict of duty and their oath to the Constitution, those bad politicians do whatever they want. And we get in some really bad situations that I think we can all see, the problems in society. That's what that freedom to do whatever you want without any standards that are higher than yourselves will produce. Now, Jesus, the most incredible moral figure who is the Son of God, he talked about that if the Son sets you free, you shall be free indeed. And the freedom is real that he's talking about is really freedom from bondage, freedom from darkness. And Dr. Stan, I know you agree with that. It's so amazing, this definition of word is so controversial. But when man says I can do whatever I want, man does not have all the answers, and we wind up with a lot of societal problems. When we had a moral standard in our country, we had a lot less crime. I mean, it wasn't about 100 years ago that a lot of people did not lock their doors at night. Times have changed because man has been put on the throne to do whatever he wants. Of course we need moral standards. Of course we need laws that reward those who produce, that protect the innocent and punish the guilty, and that's why we need to have better government in Sacramento.
And of course, as someone once said, a very wise man told me, freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want to do. Freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's law. It's a shame we've forgotten that.
And in the Eastern European Bloc countries who were under the thumb of the Soviet Union for so many years, they did not have the freedom to worship. They did not have the freedom to even engage in something called capitalism, doing a business. Well, that was bad, and it's bad here in California when Governor Gray Davis has put forth a revised budget plan to triple the car tax, to raise taxes on virtually everything you buy, and to significantly raise taxes on the higher income families. It's actually a falsehood, and today the legislative analyst, Liz Hill, said that Governor Davis's budget would balance for only a year and then dive bomb, dooming the state to $7 billion plus deficits for 5 years in a row at least. And so,
but the Governor Davis is going to get around this. He's going to borrow money from future generations so that he doesn't have to take the tough steps he should today.
Yeah, it's you can't just keep passing the buck. I liked it when we had a president in the White House who had a sign on his desk, the buck stops here. I think that was Harry Truman, right?
Right.
Harry Truman, a conservative Democrat, would make a much better governor than Governor Gray Davis, who is apparently not able to balance a budget. I'm sure he doesn't spend whatever he wants in his out of his private purse. Why is he spending whatever he wants out of the taxpayer's purse? It's really irresponsible. That's why Campaign for California Families, and for other reasons as well, is supporting the recall effort against Gray Davis. If you have not yet signed the recall effort against Gray Davis and you're a California registered voter, please visit our website, savecalifornia.com, and print out some copies of that petition, sign it, and bring it to others to sign. And that's very, very important. Because, Dr. Stan, the bad bills we're talking about that have passed, the transsexual agenda bills, and now this homosexual marriage bill, which is threatening as well, those bills, if they get on his desk, they can only be vetoed, in my opinion, if the recall signatures have been gathered and that recall is qualified for the ballot. we must see the recall as the only accountability to Governor Gray Davis at this point.
All right, fine. And you give me give that website one more time where they can get the petition, if they want to, of course.
Right. Well, thank you for the free speech of that. It's SaveCalifornia.com.
SaveCalifornia.com, right.
And you can sign up for free email updates as well. We make that available to everyone.
God bless you. Thanks so very much.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Let's go to Brad Dacus, of course, is calling from that area, from the Pacific Justice Foundation. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Oh, doing great, Dr. Stan.
Okay, fine. Well, tell us what's going on with you.
Well, we just filed a very major lawsuit against the California Teachers Association, as well as the Chino Teachers Association. This lawsuit was filed on behalf of a Christian teacher who, according to Title VII, wished to have all of her union dues to go to a charity. And the union this time said, okay, we'll let you have it go to a charity, but we're going to make you pay more to the charity than you would have had to have paid if you remained a member of the union. So they're, in essence, what they're trying to do is punish this teacher. And we've seen unions do this before, Dr. Stan, and we at the Pacific Justice Institute have been looking for a case to be able to set precedent and challenge this, because it hasn't been challenged before. And we're very hopeful that we'll set good precedents and stop this kind of just barbaric actions by unions to punish Christians and religious people and treat them like second-class citizens.
Well, is there any way, of course, to punish the union for doing that? In other words, can you just sue to get them to stop it? Can you sue them for damages for doing that? Because as long as it doesn't cost them anything, they're going to keep taking advantage of people because of their intense hatred of Christianity and everything we stand for.
Oh, I can assure you, this lawsuit, we're not only seeking an injunction, but we're also seeking damages as well as attorney fee time and everything else.
Good for you, boy. Go for it.
Yeah, Dr. Stan, we're planning on hitting them real hard because we want to make them an example for all the other unions across America that if they're going to act like hoods, mafia style, and treat religious people like second-class citizens and think they can get away with it, then they've got another thing coming. As long as we're here, we intend to follow through for such people and challenge these kind of actions.
Good for you, Brad. I wanted to get your telephone number and your website out there so people know how to get in touch with you. And I'm just so glad that you're there representing people across the state who are victims of anti-Christian bigotry.
You bet. Our telephone number is 888-305-9129-888-305. 9129, and also they can look at our webpage if they'd like to get our case updates without charge, and that's simply pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org.
Okay, fine. Thank you so very much, Brad. We'll talk to you next week, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, that was Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute, and of course, he's on the front lines in this battle to try to protect people from the unions, of course, using their power to force everybody to go along with their Marxist agenda. And of course, we can call it Marxist, call it what you will, it's a fascist agenda, really. There is no communism in Russia, there never was. There was never any communism in China. It was always a fascist system. I think we, of course, I think we lost our caller. So I'm going to ask our producer to see if they can get Joel Skousen back on again. But anyway, of course, I think it's vitally important. People understand that when we talk about communism, we're not talking about redistributing wealth to the people. We're talking about destruction of the middle class, and we're talking about a return to a feudalistic or fascist sort of system. But they can't tell the people that. They can't tell the young idealistic people that this whole thing is being pushed, a gigantic scam by people of great wealth who want you to believe in Marxism. I think the greatest shock I ever had was when I first got started in this whole study some 40 years ago, when I suddenly realized that the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Carnegie, and Ford, were pushing socialism and communism here in the United States. And you want to read the book that changed my life, and we've republished it. It's called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. foundations that power and influence, going into the Reese Committee investigation of the Great Tax-Exempt Foundations, commissioned by the 83rd Congress. No Congress has ever been allowed to investigate the Great Tax-Exempt Foundation since then, because the last thing they want the American people to learn is the fact that there really are people of great wealth who are pushing socialism. Socialism is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory. But it doesn't work without force. That's what it's really all about. And so once you understand that, you can understand why people of great wealth and power want socialism. Why? Why? Because, of course, we give the people the idea that we have a representative government. We, of course, vote for our congressmen. But those congressmen are bought and sold by people of great wealth. And instead of course representing us, they represent the interests of the small elite group. And of course, the Council on Foreign Relations is simply one of many organizations involved in this whole effort to control the lives of the American people. But it is not simply by accident that of our last 10 presidents, 6 of them came from the membership roles of the Council on Foreign Relations. Since 1953, every Secretary of State has been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Since 1953, all but one director of the CIA come from the membership role of the Council on Foreign Relations. Since 1953, every chairman of the Federal Reserve Board has come from the membership roles of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, do you think that's just by accident, that they just couldn't find anyone else in the entire country that, besides a member of the Council on Foreign Relations who would go along with their agenda to rule the American people? Well, right now we have with us online one of my favorite guests, and I'm sure he's yours too. His name is Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Hi, Joel. How are you doing tonight?
Good, Dr. Stan. It's always good to be with you.
Well, we didn't have time to talk ahead of time about our subject, but Joel puts out a weekly briefing, one of the most insightful, thought-provoking publications in the country today, and I ordinarily read it as soon as it comes. So what are we going to talk about this evening?
I'd like to spend some time analyzing with you and your audience the nature of the constant claims by the government that Al-Qaeda is behind, you know, these various attacks, and try to come to some understanding about how and what the government can know and how much of their claims are presumption and how much are based upon fact.
All right, fine. Let's go ahead and do that.
As you know, there were attacks, multiple attacks, car bombings in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, as well as in Morocco this week and the week past. The ones in Morocco didn't have any of the fingerprint of targeting American installations, though Riyadh certainly did. One of the major targets was the Vinel Corporation housing complex there. Vinel Corporation is one of the CIA front companies like DynCorp and MPRI that does military training, maintenance, and even black ops, things that the United States government doesn't want to get caught doing. They're very much hated in Saudi Arabia because they represent American influence in this Islamic country, and so it's only natural that they would be targeted. What is interesting to analyze, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, is that the United States government seems bent on immediately attaching the tag Al-Qaeda to everything in terms of a terrorist event that happens. Secretary of State Powell said this has all the fingerprints of Al-Qaeda. Well, let's analyze that for a minute. What are the fingerprints? You have an armed intrusion into a secure compound with a guard shack and a gate with at least 2 security personnel. They were machine gunned down. They knew how to operate the gate. This was a pre-planned attack. They had foreknowledge of how to operate the gate. Went inside, parked put their car in front of the targeted location and blew themselves up. So we have suicide bombing, car bombing, and forced entry attack. And I can name you dozens of similar attacks that have occurred even before Al-Qaeda even came into existence. Al-Qaeda is not fingerprinted by suicide. The PLO is the most prominent one of doing that in the state of Israel. Car bombings and truck bombings have been done for years. Marine barracks by the PLO, of course, in Lebanon and other places have been done by truck bombings, and forced entry through machine gunning has been around since the mafia went to war for prohibition. So none of these are what I would consider any unique fingerprint, unless you're going to say every act of terrorism is an act of Al-Qaeda. And I simply don't buy that. I think we have to understand very clearly that Al-Qaeda seems to be used as an excuse to continue to pump up the war on terrorism.
In fact, everything I've read, we've just about gutted the very top leadership of Al-Qaeda, other than, of course, Osama bin Laden. And as you pointed out repeatedly, the government's had repeated opportunities to take out Osama bin Laden and steadfastly refused to. And anybody would like, of course, some verification for that. We have an article out of the Washington Times where one of the government insiders is quoted as saying, "Our policy in Afghanistan and the war is not Osama bin Laden first, but Osama bin Laden last, because if we took out Osama bin Laden, how would we justify the war here in Afghanistan?" What sort of insanity is that? Unless, of course, you understand that, of course, Emmanuel Goldstein was the enemy of Big Brother. And, of course, in the world of 1984, why they would keep showing his picture on the screen of the theaters and all the screens all over this wonderful world of 1984, and everybody would boo because here was the enemy of Big Brother. Is this, of course, what Osama bin Laden is? And, of course, as Joel has pointed out, you actually know people who've come from Pakistan with information on exactly where he is, and our government has rebuffed their offers to tell them where he is?
That's correct. There have been two that I was aware of by third-party sources, and then one through first-party sources who they had not been Pakistani nationals with direct information of the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden, had been rebuffed by the United States officials in Pakistan, had traveled all the way to the United States, and had been rebuffed at the attempts to get to the White House. So they ended up calling a friend of mine who used to work on the Reagan administration. He said, "I'll get right on the phone, I'll call contacts I have in the Pentagon, and I'll get you an appointment." He did get them an appointment. And when they got there, once again, he documented that they refused to receive him. I mean, this is information that was credible. These people had first-hand information of where Osama bin Laden and wanted to tell the United States about it, and they didn't want to know.
I know. I actually heard a congressman tell the same story. This was before 9/11, and he went, of course, to the Clinton administration and said, "This is where Osama bin Laden is." Now, this was about 1989 or something. I'm sorry, 1998, 1999, after Osama bin Laden had killed so many Americans. And there was no way that we were going to do anything about Osama bin Laden. He is the Emmanuel Goldstein of today. So anyway, let's get back to this whole question about Al-Qaeda. Are they really, of course, behind all of these bombings that are going on? Is there another force behind them? Are things perhaps not exactly what they appear to be? There was a story of this last 2 weeks about, and it only appeared in the Washington Times, about the lead enforcer for the Irish Republican Army. He was a man who had killed and tortured to death over 40 people. He was the man, if anybody got out of line in the IRA or was suspected of being an informer, why he would go and torture them to death. Over 40 people were killed by him, and of course recently it was shown that he was actually a British agent who was killing people, trying to convince everybody he was really a member of the IRA, he was really working for the British government. So the British government was authorizing the killing of their own informants, the torturing of their own informants by their own agent. What sort of madness is that? Well, of course, intelligence is a dirty business. But when you actually are paying people to kill and torture 40 human lives, and you say, well, of course, it's worth it because we know what the IRA is doing. But there's something immoral about that sort of thing. Would we do that sort of thing if our English allies would do it?
Well, you know, Stan, it's pointed out one thing that I've always thought we were at a disadvantage of. If we're really fighting a battle on truth and principle, we cannot engage in the same tactics the enemy can engage in. In other words, when you go into the... A lot of people ask me, well, why don't we just infiltrate the dark side of government if you claim that there's a conspiracy and get first-hand evidence? The problem with that is that they have ways of testing people before they let you into the more initiated circles, and they require immorality and unprincipled behavior, and you can't send a good patriotic Christian individual into that atmosphere and expect him to betray his vows and his religion and his God for those reasons. We just feel we work under that disadvantage, and that doesn't mean to say that occasionally there aren't times when you have to lie when confronted with evil, because you owe evil no obligation to truth anyway. But certainly, we cannot betray other good people, whereas they have no compunction against betraying them. And it's easier for them to infiltrate our side, of course, because we aren't doing the things that are illegal or dark side operations, and they can easily come in and feign goodness.
And I think one of the most disheartening things is to realize the number of instances I know of where conservative organizations or conservative people have been befriended by somebody. They thought they were the best friend. They were actually a government informant. And this is goes on for years and years and years. They did that with Randy Weaver. They had informants at Waco. They have got several people surrounding Pat Matriciana, who put out the film The Clinton Chronicles. A man he thought was his closest friend was actually an FBI informant, giving him false information, leading him into a trap, which led to a lawsuit. And, of course, they have infiltrated the militia. In fact, they financed the militia movement in the United States for years. They have infiltrated the Communist Party. In fact, some of the leading communists were actually government informants.
It's one thing, of course, Stan, to infiltrate in order to simply gather information. And we would view that as nothing wrong with that. I wouldn't mind any government agent trying to, come in and pretend to be one of my subscribers or anything else, as long as he's simply there taking information, because he's going to find out I'm not doing anything wrong. But when you have informants that are paid to come in and suggest and attempt to promote illegal activities and get you to engage in illegal activities, that really is an evil agenda. It's attempting to create an enemy so that you can go in and prosecute them. And that explains, of course, why whenever you look at, if you look closely at any of the Ku Klux Klan rallies in the South now, and you notice who's at the microphone, there's no Southern accent. These are Northerners that have infiltrated and gone down in there. I don't think there's a legitimate Ku Klux Klan outfit out there anymore.
Well, of course, I had a very good friend who was involved. Remember the story of Mississippi Burning, where the chief civil rights... Well, the man who infiltrated the Klan for the FBI was a man named Delmar Dennis.
Right,
and
right.
The story that was never told to the American people, of course, after they found the three civil rights workers that were buried at the dam site, was that the head of the Ku Klux Klan who ordered the murder was actually had been trained by the communists when he was at UCLA. And, of course, he was given a slap on the wrist, I think 10 years in prison, something like that, and then let off. But how would you conceal that from the American people? Here was a man trained by the communists, leading the Ku Klux Klan, ordering the murder of course, the three civil rights workers, and he gets a 10-year prison sentence. Come on, there's something wrong with this story. Especially because I've had Delmar actually, while he was still alive, tell me that story, and he wrote a book about it, several books about it, and not a word of that ever got to the American people.
Yeah, it's a very similar situation, of course, to the Yitzhak Rabin murder in Israel, which was done by agent provocateurs by the Shavak. And, to this day, they have even gone through the motions of prosecuting some of the Shavak people that were involved in those agent provocateurs, and then they give them immunity, they let them off, all kinds of things happening to show that this is a, still a government-sponsored slap on the hands.
Amen to that. Well, we're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes here with, of course, Joel Skousen. And, of course, when we get back, we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our special guest this evening is Joel Skousen. Now, Joel, before I forget, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get the World Affairs Brief?
The World Affairs Brief is a weekly news analysis service that I put out by subscription. There's a very modest price for it. It comes out every week in the email. They can check those out in all the archives from last December on back on my website, www.joelskousen.com, spelled J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N. Now, there's also a print edition that comes out once each month. It's a weekly edition, but it's only printed and typeset at the end of each month. And you can get samples of those copies by calling my office number at area code 801-224-4746.
Okay, give that number just one more time.
Area code 801-224-4746.
All right, fine. Now, we have somebody on the line, line one. I wonder if my producer could tell us who that is so that we can bring them right up and let them talk to Joel here. Oh, it's Nathan. All right, fine. Nathan, did you have a question or comment for our guest?
Hi, good evening to both of you gentlemen. Dr. Skousen, it's great to talk to you. My question for you is on the overall context of terrorism, and I've never really heard this discussed. Dr. Stansman.
Stan, let me interrupt. I'm not hearing the caller.
All right, fine. Basically, he's saying that he wants to know about terrorism. Go ahead, Nathan.
Specifically, I'll try and speak louder. Specifically, I want to know, I've never really heard this discussed, but I know that Dr. Stan for a long time has been talking about world population control. And some very, very credible people have been saying that that is, in fact, an actual agenda that is very real. And I'm wondering if you've ever come across any evidence that the so-called terrorism phenomenon has been used, well, the very real terrorism phenomenon, there's nothing so-called about it, it's a very real phenomenon, but that there's some sort of a broader context to it having to do with, well, having to do, frankly, with the concept of calling the herd, or
in other words,
Malthusian aspect.
All right. In other words, I think the question would be, Joel, is this whole terrorist movement being manipulated by other forces different than perhaps the terrorists themselves? No. And, of course, in some ways it's being used to get rid of a lot of human beings who, as he uses the term, culling the herd, just kill them off because they're sort of useless people.
Well, that's kind of two parts to that question.
All right, well,
Let me cover the first part. Yes, I'm very much in agreement that terrorism worldwide is almost exclusively a controlled entity, not a spontaneous uprising, and here's the evidence of that. Primarily, we know that it requires a great deal of protection and funding of a major government entity to keep terrorism from being discovered. The training is extensive, the amount of ammunition and explosive, all controlled substances, very difficult to import. Somebody could do a few minor acts of terrorism, but, you know, to get hundreds and hundreds of pounds of explosives and high-tech ammunition and triggers and other things and have sophistication communication devices really takes a high support mechanism. I believe that most of these individual terrorists, do not realize or don't know who's actually controlling the terrorism. They simply know they have a hatred for the West or the hatred of America or a hatred of Israel, and they're carrying out their own hatred and retribution. But the go-ahead, the signals you're authorized to go ahead, or the control mechanism is beyond their knowledge, is cellular in characteristic. The major proof of what I'm saying is that if there are hundreds of terrorist cells, as the FBI claims, of Al-Qaeda in the United States, we must really ask, why have there been no legitimate, normal types of terrorism? No car bombings, no suicide bombings, no electrical pylon towers being bombed. There's no protection for those. You could pack explosives into a car, drive it up to a shopping mall, and let the thing off, even by, you know, remote control or cell phone or a clock timer. And none of those things have happened. You know, all we have are these high-profile terrorist events. Those, to me, are the greatest indications that these are agent provocateurs. and manipulated by governments. And I think we have to ask who benefits from these and who has an ulterior motive to direct the American people in that regard. Now, in regards to the second question, I do not believe that there is a general motivation simply to get rid of people or, you know, through terrorism. I think all terrorism is specifically targeted either at a government because of a government regime change or done by government to targeting their own people to get them to accept in an Hegelian manner things which they would not accept without a major terrorist event.
All right, fine. Does that answer your question, Nathan?
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, fine. Thanks very much. Okay, fine. And, of course, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Joel, of course, is talking about these terrorist attacks. We're seeing them over in Saudi Arabia. And there's something very strange about these attacks in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia has been funding so much of the world terrorist movement, both before September 11th and since then. And if you doubt that, we've got all sorts of articles on it. But there certainly is an excellent book. We carry is called Hatred's Kingdom. It's written by Dor Gold, former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, and he certainly knows what's going on. And he points out that even as late as October of last year, why, of course, these Saudi princes with fabulous wealth have been giving literally hundreds of millions of dollars to the terrorists were meeting with the Hamas, which, of course, is doing everything they can to disrupt the Palestinian-Israeli peace talks, which we are backing. So on one hand, we're backing the peace talks. On the other hand, our ally is doing everything they can to disrupt the peace talks. What's wrong with this scenario?
Well, one of the things that's wrong with that scenario is, and what's unsaid even by Dory Gold, who I've met and talked to with in Israel, he's very intelligent. He does have a considerable establishment background, though. And, so even though much of what he says is very, very valuable, sometimes he omits the key elements. And one of the key elements...
You're absolutely right. I'm laughing because so often, you know, they will tell you a lot, a part of the truth, enough to make you believe you're getting the whole truth.
You see, the crucial truth here that Ambassador Gold has not mentioned and will never mention is the fact that the government of the United States has given the wink and the nod to Saudi Arabia to go ahead and fund al-Qaeda as a third-party funding regime so that the U.S. basically has plausible deniability of ever having anything to do with al-Qaeda. That's why, in my opinion, the U.S. has not put effective sanctions on Saudi Arabia for its funding of terrorism, because, in fact, they are doing the bidding of the United States. In other words, I believe that al-Qaeda was a creation of the CIA. We know that from CIA's own admission. They claim that they lost control of it. We have substantial evidence to dispute that they, in fact, still have contact. But I think... in fact, that they only have contact at the highest levels, and that even mid-level and lower level, none of them know that there's anything but hatred driving al-Qaeda. They don't realize that I think that this is a terrorism being fomented for the purpose of continuing this eternal war, putting the United States in an eternal war situation whereby our civil liberties can be easily derailed as they have been.
I don't know if you ever read that La Figueroa article that went into the background. It was in July of the year 2001.
Yes, Le Figueroa, yes.
Where actually, of course, they pointed out that Osama bin Laden had been in the American hospital in Dubai, and of course there he was meeting with the CIA and with members of his family. Now, what was really significant about the article was not that here 2 months before the September 11th attack, the wicked Osama bin Laden was meeting with the CIA station chief. But, of course, very shortly after that, they arrested a member of al-Qaeda who was about to bomb the American embassy in Paris. And somebody had given this our intelligence agencies information that this man was planning to bomb the American embassy. And, of course, it was pointed out that when this man was arrested, this Arab terrorist, al-Qaeda terrorist, he said, well, Osama bin Laden told me to do it. Now, isn't it interesting, Osama, and of course this was the inference from the article, Osama bin Laden meets with an agent of the CIA. Shortly thereafter, this man who's been told to bomb the American embassy in France, in Paris, is arrested by our intelligence agencies, and he said, gee, Osama bin Laden told me to do it. What's wrong with this picture? And, of course, the inference was, why Osama bin Laden? It told the CIA exactly what was coming down, and, of course, they moved in, and they thwarted this attack. And, of course, Osama bin Laden was, of course, playing both sides, or maybe the CIA was playing both sides.
Well, let me give a perspective on how actual intelligence is derived and why I think that these phony warnings about al-Qaeda are, in fact, built upon a system of assumptions. People have to realize that terrorist organizations don't keep central lists of their personnel for the U.S. to discover. Everything's organized into small cells with very few links to the hierarchy above them. There's nothing to prove who is who at any given time except perhaps, you know, the forced testimony elicited from captives. And even that sometimes we don't understand because obviously being that al-Qaeda is originally a creation of the United States, they will know most of the hierarchy, and so they can sacrifice some of those lesser people, as I think they've done, by capturing them and claiming that they've made some great intelligence coup. And so you cannot necessarily trust people who are working as double or triple agents in what they may say. In any case, you know, we never hear the testimony of any of those people captured by the CIA. We only hear a CIA spokesman telling us what those people may have revealed. And it's even worse when you talk about electronic eavesdropping. Now, the U.S. eavesdrop through the echelon system all over the world. They often pick up, of course, cryptic conversations of a terrorist plan or operation. Now, never do any of these conversations that they're eavesdropping mention the word al-Qaeda. They don't have conversations like, this is Osama bin Laden calling, I want to talk to Sheikh bin so-and-so, chief of European operations. You see, they don't have those kinds of things. They use false names. They drop false trails. They change names from time to time. They use code names. So, conveniently, of course, the CIA talks about chatter. Well, there's a lot of chatter about terrorism and people. What they mean by chatter is, we don't have any names or titles. We don't know who they're aiming. They haven't talked about any targets. We're just picking up more chatter, meaning more people talking. Well, it's just very, very difficult to prove anything. That's one of the reasons why the FBI and CIA have never been able to say, when they talk about we have a terrorist threat or we're going to Orange Alert, but we have no specific threat that we perceive. Well, of course not. They're simply talking about an increase in chatter. But they always put a title of al-Qaeda on it. And that's what's so bothersome, because, you see, if they were really being honest, they would simply tell us what they know and what they don't know, and instead of putting this title of al-Qaeda, it's impossible specifically bring out that title when people aren't using al-Qaeda in their actual conversations. They're simply assuming that this is al-Qaeda because it has political ramifications.
All right, fine. Of course, what they're doing, of course, is terrorizing the American people. And, of course, as you know, just today we went from code yellow to code orange. And, of course, that is because of the bombings over in Saudi Arabia, which we attributed to al-Qaeda. And, after all, we wouldn't have gone from code yellow to code orange unless, of course, the lives of the American people were at stake. In fact, just last week, they had these simulated terrorist attacks on Chicago and Seattle. And, of course, the American people are being intermittently frightened to death and then allowed to relax and then frightened to death again. And each time we're told, of course, it's extremely dangerous. The terrorists are going to get you if you don't watch out.
Now, there's another interesting circumstance happening here in Salt Lake City. And it has to do with the Olympics. During the Olympics, the people of Salt Lake City got used to a heightened level of security, random checks at the airport, magnetic weapons detectors going through every public building and every venue into the Olympics. They're taking advantage of that now by still implementing those security measures around Salt Lake City. They still have random checks of vehicles at the airport, all in the name of Homeland Security, of course. And it's very interesting because very few of the Americans are challenging this. You know, even under the Patriot Act, they don't have the right to do random checks. You've still got to be suspected of terrorism. My brother, my nephew, son of Mark Skousen, the newsletter advisor, was traveling to the airport to pick up his father, who was coming to visit, and he was stopped in one of these checks. And being, you know, trained, and as most Skousins are, to know about the Constitution, he said, no, I'm not going to submit to a search. I'm going to stand on my Fourth Amendment rights. And the police officer didn't know what the Fourth Amendment was. He said, well, what's that say? You can imagine that police officer not knowing what the Fourth Amendment was. He let him go, though. He did not search the car, though, because he had this legal stand that he was going to make. And I think you have to be careful how you do that, because they are trained that if you appear to be too much of a constitutional conservative, you know, they're trained to take you in and harass you in many jurisdictions. I know that's happened in a couple of people flying into Montrose, Colorado. But this is very dangerous. They're getting people used to illegal searches and seizures. And I think the people ought to take the time to protest and say, no, I don't think you have probable cause, and I'm not suspected of terrorism, and I'm going to stand on my Fourth Amendment's rights against unreasonable search and seizure.
All right, fine. We've got Mike calling in from Santa Cruz. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Stan. I just want to ask Joel one question about the appointment of Hamid Karzai. I understand that it was some European council that put him in office as the Prime Minister of Afghanistan. I wondered, do you know who that council was? What was their title? Who were the people involved? Or any details about that?
Could you relay the question?
Basically, the question is that Karzai, who is the Prime Minister of Afghanistan, and Mike was saying he wanted to know who'd put him in power. He had heard it was some people in England.
No, a European council.
A European council had put him in.
He is correct. I have that in my files. I don't have on the top of my head, but he is correct. There was a European Council that was part of the EU that was advising. They were part of the advising the United Nations, or the U.S. brought in to help select that, and they were the ones who came up with Karzai's name. Of course, the U.S. was already familiar with him, being that he worked for UNOCAL as an executive, but he's right. I just don't happen to have the name.
Hadn't he actually lived here in the United States for a time, Karzai?
Actually, I believe it was London.
He lived in London. Okay, well, at least he wasn't living in Afghanistan. He does not represent the people of Afghanistan. He is simply a figurehead we put in power, and of course the real power, apparently, in Kabul is the head of the Northern Alliance, and of course they are Marxist communists.
But
they're the real power behind what's going on over there, and we put them in power.
Well, Karzai is an Afghan, and
right.
he worked for UNOCAL for at least, well, somewhere around 7 or 8 years as the chief negotiator between UNOCAL and the Taliban,
sure,
to see about getting the oil line across Afghanistan. He must have done something of a good job, but he obviously failed, but they liked him enough to send him on to be prime minister.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much, Mike. Okay, fine. And, of course, Joel, of course, I think that it should be pretty obvious that Karzai is simply a figurehead for big American oil companies. I think that it should be so blatant for everybody in the world to see, except for the American people, who can't believe we would have fought that whole battle really about oil rather than, you know, having anything to do with capturing the wicked Osama bin Laden. Remember, we went to war to capture the wicked Osama bin Laden. That was our excuse for going to war.
And also, of course, to destroy the al-Qaeda infrastructure. And there's no indication that al-Qaeda was there. Those camps were all empty, or mostly empty, by the time that we attacked them. You don't think they'd be sitting around waiting for the U.S. to come and attack. That's why there really wasn't much to... whatever network there was disbanded to the wind. In fact, Osama bin Laden had an entourage of several thousand Arab bodyguards and protectors, and we watched them leave Afghanistan. The U.S. Used satellite photographs to detect that they were taking shipboard and heading for Iran and for other places in the Middle East, and failed to interdict them, even though they admitted that they had satellite photos of them embarking on ships. So that's why, you know, we didn't find any Arabs there particularly. It's also noteworthy that the opium poppy is now at maximum production again within a year after the overthrow of the Taliban. And it's interesting that this happens under the U.S. The U.S. supposedly gave the Taliban $25 million in order to eradicate opium production and to compensate the farmers for the lack of income there. And as soon as the U.S. takes back over the country, opium production's back up again.
What's wrong with this picture? Anyway, of course, there's so many things that the American people never stop and think about. After all, we have to be against drugs because we have a war on drugs. Or is the war really on drugs, or is it on the American people? Are we using the war on drugs to, of course, massively increase government control and monitoring of law-abiding citizens?
You know, it's interesting as an update on Iraq that Ahmed Chalabi, who the United States is still trying to convince the Iraqis to accept as an interim leader there, has set himself up. You know, it's very interesting. These people get hold of this magic bullet file or set of files of intelligence. You know, this bombed out Iraqi intelligence building, all of a sudden within hours, you have one of the favorite reporters of the CIA at the Telegraph in Britain being the recipient of just tens of these files, which incriminate, of course, unpopular politicians in Britain, or incriminate the relationships between France and Iraq, or incriminate, in this case, Chalabi's gotten a hold of files which incriminate Jordan of having an in-depth relationship with Saddam Hussein. Well, this shouldn't come of any surprise. Jordan was the primary trading partner of Iraq, even during sanctions time. I mean, almost everything that came in or out, even with the UN Food for Peace, Oil for Peace, Oil for Food program, came through Jordan. Of course, they're going to have incredibly complex and detailed relationships between Jordan and Saddam Hussein. But it's very telling that Ahmed Chalabi will use this to discredit Jordan. I think that he's trying to get Jordan to back down on its extradition request. Chalabi is wanted there, of course, for bilking people out of the former Iraqis who had fled to Jordan, millions of dollars invested in the Petra Bank, which he began with other investors and went to prison, or was charged and convicted for.
But he didn't go to prison, didn't he? Leave the country or something?
Yes, he went into exile to England, where he left, lived in plush accommodations with international and CIA funding over the years.
And of course, the thing is that, of course, he's come back to Iraq with literally hundreds of armed people, all financed by the CIA.
Right, and no one else was allowed to have armed troops, you know, when they came back in, except these preferred people. So it's very typical what the U.S. is doing there in terms of, you know, setting up a puppet regime. And, of course, you have to have arms in order to have any power there in Iraq, now that you have a vacuum of order and you have looting that apparently is still constantly a problem. It's very interesting that the U.S. continues to reverse its role in Iraq. At first of all, they say, well, we're going to have a provisional government within, you know, 30 days, and then they say, no, we're not going to be able to do that for a while. Then they say we're going to have three occupation zones and then four. And this thing is in a tremendous amount of flux. The U.S. clearly does not have a handle on things on the ground and is desperately attempting to manipulate the various factions there in order to keep them at bay until they can figure out, you know, who will whose arms can be twisted and who can be put into government, you know, with some fanfare to represent ostensibly a democracy.
I have the incredible things, you know, that they couldn't foresee the looting of the museum. Supposedly, we're told orders were given to protect the museum that has these priceless artifacts, or priceless documents and tablets and all. And of course, they just forgot to guard the museum. And then, of course, the nuclear plants. Apparently, there were nuclear plants there, and there was nobody to guard them, and they were looted, and all the debris was stolen, and supposedly there were barrels filled with radioactive material that were dumped out. They used them to store water, and then all these people are supposedly getting radiation poisoning, and of course, very, very sick people from radiation. I'm assuming, of course, that story is true, but you would think that if there were nuclear plants there, why, we would have guarded those. It seems that we really didn't have any plan at all for when we got in there, but we did have a plan that allowed these things to happen.
Well, we certainly did have a plan to safeguard the oil installations.
Right.
The U.S. went in immediately and took possession of the oil ministry, made sure there was guards set up around there and no looting whatsoever. They could have done the same thing for the Iraqi national treasures in the museum. They could have done the same thing for various power establishments and hospitals. They did none of that. And, of course, as I had mentioned, I thought in a previous show that we were on together that I listened to National Public Radio, one of the top experts, a colonel, retired colonel in the U.S. Army who was an expert in rebuilding infrastructure in a country after a war, about, and he said it's going to take 18 months to get the generation, water systems, and sewer supplies back working in, not 2 months, as Paul Bremer is talking about. But he said, you know, I talked to the administration numerous times before this war started, said this is what we need to safeguard and get these things back into operations to keep civilian casualties down, and says it's not going to happen. That would cost an extra 6 months of preparing for this war, and the administration says we will not tolerate any delays in going to war. Now, that, to me, was proof of what I'd been saying many months before, and what you were saying. There was a hell-bent on wheels, hell-bent on going to war attitude in the Bush administration, and you know, they were able to play games with the United Nations while they were building up and getting ready for this, but as soon as they were ready, they weren't taking any more delays, and they weren't going to, and those delays would have saved a lot of civilian lives and a lot of civilian unrest that's going on right now. But they didn't want to have the kind of preparation and the double the amount of troops it would have taken in order to safeguard Iraqi infrastructure.
Well, of course, there obviously was another agenda behind what's going on, but the American people can't believe that, nor can they believe that our real motivation had nothing to do with those weapons of mass destruction. And what really disturbs me so much today is that most people aren't even concerned about the fact that after guaranteeing that there were weapons of mass destruction, we knew where they were, we knew exactly where they were, we were going to get those to protect the American people. We couldn't wait any longer because Saddam Hussein was going to turn them over to the wicked Osama bin Laden or somebody else, and then they can't find any weapons of mass destruction. As you pointed out, of course, our government knew that they'd been transferred into Syria, and of course, but they couldn't tell the American people that. We're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Well, notice how easily they let Syria off the hook, knowing that they've received those weapons of mass destruction. As long as Syria says, yeah, we want to play ball with you, they're saying without inspections, without handing them over, they're letting them off the hook. So this is another example of high-handed hypocrisy.
Well, of course, the thing is, of course, are they just doing this temporarily till we've consolidated our position?
Well,
you think
well
Syria is next on the line.
They may well be used that as an excuse later on, but it's still hypocritical to be able to not push it right now, because if those weapons of mass destruction really are threatening us right now, then they are threatening us right now, not 6 months from now when they decide to make it an issue.
Well, we live in this world gone mad. There are only a few of us who are sane, and everybody thinks we're crazy. God bless you, Joel. Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest has been Joel Skousen. His publication, of course, World Affairs Brief, and if you don't read it, you're missing something. We'll look forward to having you on to one of our programs again in the near future.
Thank you, Dr.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, that's Joel Skousen, certainly one of my favorite guests, and we do hope that many of you will want to pray for America. You'll pray for our leaders and our ministers, for our boys who are overseas, and but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until, well, it'll be Thursday now, when we'll be back with you. Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.